Want to hear more? With your Amazon device or Alexa app, say, Alexa, play country farm sounds, and escape to a mid-1900s farm where you will take a walk during the morning chores.
Iowa Soybean Association is driven to deliver for Iowa's 40,000 soybean farmers. We're proud to provide objective agronomic research, a helping hand with soil and water stewardship, and timely industry news powered by the Soybean Checkoff. Learn more at iasoybeans.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome into the MTOM Show podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. We're on remote for this episode, just like we were last week talking about the Rockefeller Foundation. This week, we're going to get into the State Department. What's the State Department have to do with agriculture, you ask? Well, that's what we posed the question to Dr. Kerry Fowler. He is a special envoy for global food security for the United States State Department. He's been to the World Food Prize before. He was on a panel last year. He's on a panel this year. We are going to discuss the issue of food security. We'll also get into mapping of soils, not necessarily in precision agriculture in the United States, but globally, and what that can mean for food production as well as food security. This is an episode where we're going to get heavy into policy and just bigger ideas of thinking. We're looking for a moonshot. Let's see what we find out on this installment of the MTOM Show podcast. What's your first Norman Borlaug memory? When did you first become aware of the guy that this is all based on?
Well, I was a member of the Board of Trustees of CIMMET, the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, and that's where he did most of his work. And he was retired, if you could ever say that Norm Borlaug retired. Was retired, but still had an office there, was still going to work every morning. We had breakfast every morning when I would go to board meetings because I'd get up early, he'd get up early. But I remember I wanted to somehow rope him into some project that I was doing. I needed his help. And I thought for a long time how I could convince him to do that. And I finally landed on a strategy, and I knocked on his door, and he said, come in. He said, hi, Kerry. And I said, Norm, do you want to fish or cut bait? And he just smiled and said, fish. The part of the story that I think is the funniest is I can't remember what happened after that, what I asked him for.
You weren't sure what you were even asking him for
right.
That day? Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, I'm sure I was asking him for something, but I can't remember it now. But I remember his reaction. And it was so typical of Norm just to be a go-getter, jump right in and be engaged. He was a person of limited patience. I mean, he wanted action.
Which is hard when you're mixing government and private entities and around the world to have patience.
Yeah.
What, from his inspiration, has, do you think, made this event what it is?
Well, I think if you really look carefully at Norm Borlaug's life, at the surface, you might say, well, he's the person who bred short stature wheats and much higher yielding and dealt with wheat stem rust and various things like that. So you might think of him as a scientist. But really what he was, I think, at heart, in addition to the scientist part, was he was an organizer and a doer, and he made it happen. So it's not enough, you know, just to breed a new variety of wheat or corn. If you want to have that spread all over the world and really be instrumental in food security, you got to go through all kinds of barriers and overcome all kinds of obstacles, political and administrative and all that. And that he was stubborn and persistent, and he just... at the end of the day, he was going to make it happen.
You've been to this event before. I remember listening to you on a panel last year in the rooms that are off to our side here. Why, when this was put on your schedule, or did you ask to put this on your schedule, that you felt it was important to be here and represent the State Department?
Well, this has to be on the schedule. This event is the most unique world food security event in the world. It's the only place where you can come every year and meet people from all walks of life within the agriculture space. So you've got plant breeders and geneticists, but ag economists and nutritionists and everybody, and they're all focused on...
Don't forget the farmer that's here.
And the farmers are here from all over the world. So it's this wonderful mix, and you get the most interesting discussions. But I tell you, one of the things that I really love about it, the young people. And that was the one area, by the way, where Norm Borlaug had a whole lot of patience. It was with young people. He was, I think, really inspiring to young people. He was inspired by them. And he would mentor them and encourage them to no end. And when I come to these meetings, I go away with a lot of energy from the young people.
Normally it's the adult that has no patience for kids and patience for adults. So to have that flipped is fun. Help me understand, though, State Department versus USDA and how you're both involved with food, right? But that's there's completely different lanes. What's the delineation?
Well, the USDA lane is very practical and pragmatic, but it's domestic focused, and the State Department is the diplomatic arm of government. So we're quite interested, as is the USDA, but we're the diplomatic arm of the U.S. government abroad. So we're interested in food security for a couple of reasons. One is obvious. It's the humanitarian side of our government. It's the face on the values that we have in this country. The other is it's a national security question. Without food security, you don't really have national security. There's a very tight correlation between food insecurity and civil conflict, civil war, these kinds of things. And this Arab Spring started at a point when food prices rose very dramatically. It was an El Nino year, by the way. Food production went down, food prices shot up, and people were hot and bothered.
I've always been told that we're only 3-4 meals skipped away from conflict. Is that something that's talked about at State?
Well, at the moment, we're seeing a world where we have fairly low grain stockpiles. This is an El Nino year that typically shaves a couple percent off of production globally, but it's concentrated in certain areas. Mm-hmm. So we would expect to see, and are seeing right now, drought in Southern Africa and probably a reduced production of grain in Australia. This is going to have an impact on food prices, but when you live hand to mouth, as many people do in Southern Africa, this could shape up to be a humanitarian crisis as well.
You mentioned food security. Give me is that definition change over time?
Well, the different organizations that work on this issue, like the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, will have their definitions of it. But I think what we really are aiming for is that everyone has access to a good diet at all times of the year. And in this country, it's hard to really understand that in many parts of the world, food security is a seasonal matter. And off-season is the lean and hungry part of the year. And what we're trying to do, I think, is to look beyond just the simple necessity for providing people with enough calories, because calories alone are not a definition of food security. Food security is also nutritional security, and it means trying to help countries become a little more self-provisioning for those for a broad range of crops and micro and macronutrients. We also have to realize that food aid is not the same thing as food security. And I think in the world today, what we're seeing is that the gap between our ability to provide that food aid is growing in terms of the need. And we really have to help countries do a better job of producing food.
Is it safe to say that food aid becomes political? Food security is not?
I don't think so. It's interesting to me, and it's important to me that this whole area is bipartisan. I don't know what the Republican versus Democratic position is on this issue. I think, in a fundamental way, all of us in America have certain values, and I think those are manifested in government policy. So this is, I think, and I hope, one of the areas that where there can be collaboration between the parties and we don't have big fights.
I had a conversation with the Rockefeller Foundation about this issue, and I told the story that I'd heard about someone saying, going to the Food Bank of Iowa for assistance. Oh, those are just people who are lazy. And I was stopped. Raj stopped me and said, no, it goes different. And he explained, what is it globally that it's looked upon when a country asks for help, or we see that there is a need mm-hmm. for help that the United States could offer?
If you look at some of the countries in Africa, I'm focused on that, by the way, because that's where the greatest number of food insecure people are, and it's where the greatest need is. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways it's where the greatest potential is as well. Africa is going to be the most populated continent on Earth by the end of the century. So it's in our interest, and obviously in theirs, that they become more food secure. When I look at some of those countries, you see some pretty systemic problems, such as poor soils. Mm. And it seems like a no-brainer to me, but what I've been saying to people is, there's no such thing as food security based on bad soil and unadapted crops.
You mentioned soil, and we're going to get into it. I guess we'll go now. In this country, the farmer knows down to the foot where it's good, where it's not. Is that the same idea when you talk about soil mapping? What's your broad before we get down to that foot by foot?
Sure. Well, in this country, we have precision agriculture, right? And so you have combines and tractors that are GPS linked, and you know almost foot by foot what's mm-hmm. happening. In many developing countries, you don't know kilometer by kilometer. So if you've got a small family subsistence kind of farm that might be 2 acres large, you don't know what kind of soil you have. And therefore, you really don't have a good basis for planning, for knowing which kind of crops you need on that land and what you can do with it long term. In Africa, you have some of the oldest, most weathered, frankly, most eroded soils. And there really needs to be some, program, if you will, to kind of restore, recapitalize those soils. And it starts with information. It starts with the governments knowing what soils they have so they can engage in rational land use planning and know where to focus production of a particular crop or not to grow anything at all. And the farmers need it for farm level management.
So if we, as a farmer in that village mm-hmm. who always thought that this is the crop I'm supposed to plant there, might come out, the soils testing might come back and say, really, we think you should plant this instead. Is that what you're meaning?
Yeah, but you know,
in a very broad sense of the word.
Well, in the old days in this country, we had a lot of extension agents. Mm. Farmers can now get a lot of that information from their cell phone. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Africa, there are 165 million cell phone accounts. And farmers are doing, even subsistence farmers, doing their banking and doing all kinds of transactions with the cell phone. So one of the things I think could help a lot in Africa is taking that kind of macro soil information that you get from satellite mapping and modeling it with local information about the soils and giving the farmers information and even recommendations about what they can do with their land most productively.
Because I think a lot of Americans might just, oh, Africa, third world, there's no technology. But you're telling me that is far from it.
It's a different world. So some of the things that we're promoting and what gives me a lot of hope is that it's a different world in Africa now. There's much more capacity, human and otherwise. The political support is there. We have new technologies for breeding crops, for example. So I think there's reason to believe that we can make some transformative changes.
Are there certain countries where you're paying attention to or where mapping could benefit a producer and food security the most?
Well, in terms of the soils work that we're trying to promote, I think much of Africa is behind the curve in terms of what they have. It's far, far less than what a farmer here would have. And I think farmers here would tell you they need to know their soils to be mm-hmm. good farmers.
Just like in Africa, this country, mm-hmm. we have weather issues. We have climate issues. How does climate challenges, changes, alterations fit into some of your work in Africa?
Well, Africa is predicted to be one of the continents that will be hardest hit by changes in climate. This again, you could say, well, this is a political issue to talk about climate change. But when I talk with farmers and even gardeners, we talk about bad weather and extreme weather. And by the way, how a farmer or gardener adapts to the weather is the same. whether you believe in climate change or you don't believe in climate change, you still need to have good adapted crops for whatever the weather conditions are. I think that you know, in Africa, we are seeing some really extreme weather events, and we're seeing some consistency to the droughts and to the high heat as well. So if you're a farmer there and you say, well, you know, I expect the upcoming season to be a normal season, mm-hmm. what normal are we talking about? Is there a new normal? So again, I think largely through plant breeding efforts, we can help farmers find adapted varieties for those conditions.
You're from the government. You're here to help, right? I guess is the model. But where does the
How many words is that?
Exactly. but where is the line between government and private foundations trying to do this work mm-hmm. that you're talking about? Who has to lead?
Yeah.
Who has to be along for the ride and do work to roll up their sleeves?
Well, I hope nobody's along for the ride. Private foundations have a really important role to play. They can be nimble and quick. We have processes in government to come to certain decisions or programs. But I one of the things that I found interesting coming into government, I've been with the State Department a year and a half now, is the open-mindedness, I think, of people in government, private sector with whom we work very closely, private philanthropies like the Gates Foundation or Rockefeller Foundation. I think there's just a real openness, and it also spans the different disciplines, the nutritionists and the plant breeders and the ag economists. And part of that is the fact that we're really in a global food crisis, that we have more than 700 million people on Earth who are food insecure. Now, an interesting thing is that, you know, we started talking about that because of Russia's invasion mm-hmm. of Ukraine. That really was the spark that hit us last year. But but since then, media attention, no offense, has really gone down, while the number of food insecure people has gone up.
And that's the stat I've heard this week that has been talked about, is the numbers have gone up. Why?
Yeah. Well, because we haven't solved the underlying problems. When Russia invaded Ukraine, we became very well aware of how conflict has an impact on food security. And it's one of the major causes. I think 60 or so percent of the people who are food insecure, they live in countries that are experiencing conflict. But there's climate, there are weather issues. COVID was we took a big hit from COVID. And then there are the kind of traditional problems, if you will, of lack of investment and low stockpiles and things like this. We really had the perfect, we are in the middle of the perfect storm.
What calms the storm?
Well, I think it's I think it takes ourselves being calm and thinking long-term and very systematically and rationally about this. One of the things that we're doing at the State Department is promoting what we call the vision for adapted crops and soils. We've talked a little bit about mm-hmm. soils. But if you look at Africa, the major staple crops in Africa are all imported crops, maize that originated in Central America, Asian rice from Asia, bananas from Asia, wheat from the Near East. And if you look forward, those crops are having fairly stable yield increases every year. But those yield increases are not taking us to where we need to be to provide food security. So we're looking at some of the traditional and indigenous African crops, where some of those are familiar to a lot of people, sorghum and millet and cassava and such. But a lot of them are crops that you've never heard of before that have a huge amount of potential, but we, the international communities,
sure.
never really invested in them.
You mentioned the yield going up, but you're saying it's not keeping up with the population growth.
That's right.
And as we find new crops and new opportunities, are we looking at the crops? I mean, in America, we always talk about, well, we'll go with what's most profitable. That's always what wins. But I guess, is there crops out there that can have, I won't say moonshots, but mm-hmm. greatest impact? If we can just start growing these three things, the world will change.
Well, we have really looked at the whole range of indigenous crops in Africa. There are about 300 indigenous crops. to find which are the ones that could provide the most or the best nutrition for people year-round mm-hmm. and for all kinds of people. But particularly, I must say, for women and children, the stunting rate in Africa is of children under five is just horrendous. A quarter, sometimes a third of the children are stunted, and that means mentally and physically, and that'll last the rest of their lives. So if you're going to be very rational about this and you want to make long-term sustainable improvements, you're going to look at the crops that can provide really good nutrition year-round. That's what we're doing, and we think some of these crops, particularly in the vegetables and the legumes and nitrogen-fixing, you know, beans and such, are high potential opportunity crops, if you will.
So that's a little bit of it's an outside part of the research and development, the mm-hmm. R&D of things. But where do you see? I heard yesterday it was talked about it at one of the sessions that we don't have enough of the smartest of the smart going into agriculture right now.
Yeah.
Why do we need the smartest of the smart going into agriculture?
Well, yeah, agriculture is one of the most complicated businesses you can be in. Sometimes people that maybe are urbanites think, well, it's a simple thing. You go out and plant the seed, and sometime a few months later, you harvest the crop. Farmers making decisions on a day-to-day basis with the most amazing, almost incalculable number of variables going on. And they put themselves on the line. You plant a seed, and you're also planting a lot of hope for yourself, and you don't know what's going to come. There are not too many businesses that are that complicated, and so I think there are a lot of places where young people can plug in. And one of the things that I love about the Borlaug Dialogue and the World Food Prize is it exposes a lot of young people to a diverse set of expertise of old folks like me. And sometimes the spark is lit young people say, wow, you know, I didn't know you could have a career doing that.
Mm-hmm. You might find the next Borlaug. We don't know. I mean, there might be someone down there.
Look, you know, the last big quantum leap we made in food production in this world was due to Norman Borlaug.
So in that sense, we're due for another big idea.
I was going to say, what do we need? We need a few more Borlaugs.
When you had the opportunity to talk to the American farmer, which usually mm-hmm. likes to listen to this or watch this, why do they need to care about what's going on with the work that you're doing mm-hmm. on a day-to-day basis? How do they fit in and maybe even can help?
Yeah. There are a number of ways I'd answer that question. I by the way, I live on a farm. I did live on a farm before I migrated to Washington for this job a year and a half ago. And I have a family farm in Tennessee that's still in the family, fifth or sixth generation now. My experience is that farmers care about other farmers. So you talk to a farmer here about farm problems that are going on in Bangladesh or Zambia or something, and there's an immediate empathy. So because they know what that life is like, and they want that other farmer to succeed. I suppose if you want to get it down to dollars and cents, it's good for our American agriculture to have prosperous agriculture in other countries, particularly in continents like Africa, because at the moment it's not a huge market for machinery, for seeds, for food, or anything else. And how will it become a huge market? It's if the agriculture is lifted up and it becomes a little bit more prosperous.
Well, it gets back to one of the questions I asked you earlier about mm-hmm. is it government, is it private entity, but private business. You look mm-hmm. at the John Deere or the Case, those that see opportunity in those countries for profitable have to understand it might not be profitable, but it's also for the greater good if they put efforts in those
places.
Well,
I can remember a discussion I had with the vice president of one of the African countries, and they said, well, you know, there's a lot of technology out there. We need to just use it and scale it up. Can you help us with that? And my response was, well, can you, in your government with your resources, which are limited, can you scale it up? No. I said, do you think that the United States we have the resources mm-hmm. and the ability to scale it up for you? She said, no, probably not. I said, we have to look to the private sector.
And it's a team effort.
Yeah, absolutely.
Finally here, as we just heard the chimes to send people into sessions, you've been on, you were on a panel last year. What's your panel you're on this year, and what have you, who were you with?
I was with someone from the CGIAR, the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. It's a consortium of large agricultural research centers. And we were talking about this program we have at the State Department called VAX, which Vision for Adapted Crops and Soils. We needed an acronym.
It is the government.
Yeah, yeah. We were on this panel with last year's Food Prize laureate, Cynthia Rosenzweig, who's a climate modeler, and the vice president of EFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development. So we're really trying to popularize this approach, and it's not just a series of programs or initiatives. What we're really trying to impress upon people, particularly abroad, is that food security fundamentally depends on the fundamentals, and the fundamentals are good soils and adapted crops. Mm-hmm. And we can do all kinds of great, fun, fancy, sexy things with the technology and agriculture, and my gosh, you know, we could talk a long time about those things. But fundamentally, we have to take care of business, and business is the soil and the crop.
And our business is time. And we're out of it. Dr. Fowler, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Enjoy the time when you get back to the farm there in West Tennessee. And we'll see you next time.
Sure. Thanks so much. Appreciate you having me.
My thanks to Carrie Fowler here at the Borlaug Dialogues as part of the World Food Prize celebration of Dr. Norman Borlaug. If you want to find any of the past episodes, you can easily go to our YouTube channel and watch them all. They're in video format. Or subscribe and follow where you get your podcast. It's the MTOM Show podcast. It comes out each and every Tuesday. If you have feedback for the show, send it in an email, market to market at iowapbs.org. We'll see you next time.